This is Ed Asner, and you're listening to No Lies Radio.
I'm your host, Kevin Barrett. I'm on doing this live show every Friday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 to 9 where I am, Central Time, and whatever time it is wherever you may be, talking about the most important things that you're not allowed to talk about in polite company at your mother's dinner table, etc., etc. Tonight, two huge topics. The first hour will be devoted to the 50th anniversary of the brutal Israeli attack on the USS Liberty, an unarmed American spy ship. This was during the War of Aggression in 1967. Israel grabbed a bunch of land, including the Holy Land of Jerusalem, holy to the world's nearly 4.5 billion Muslims and Christians, as well as the relative paltry handful of Jews who seem to think that they own the place exclusively, and they're committing genocide to get it and keep it exclusively, setting up a Jewish superiority state in occupied Palestine. And that's what the 67 war was about. And the attack on the Liberty is a perfect microcosm of that insane, psychopathic Zionist brutality. We'll talk about that in the first hour. Then in the second hour, talk about more insane, probably largely Zionist brutality. Ian Greenhall of Veterans Today will come on to discuss the Manchester false flag. Ian lives not that far from Manchester. He's staying up till 2 in the morning, I understand. I hope he is anyway, to talk about this. So it should be a great show. But let's see if we can get going here with our guests from the USS Liberty. Well, actually, one of them, Phil Turney, was actually on the Liberty, and he's written this amazing book with the help of the other guest, Dave Gary. It's called Erasing the Liberty, and it's come out now in time for the 50th anniversary of the Liberty atrocity. So we're going to see if we can bring up Dave and Phil now. See if we can. We think we got them both on the way up here. And this is a really great book, I'll tell you. I know Phil's written about Liberty before. Hey, we've got Dave on the line. Hello, Dave. How are you?
How are you, Kevin?
All right. And here comes Phil. Welcome, Phil.
Well, hey. How you doing, Kevin? How you doing, David?
Good, Phil. Thanks. Hope you're doing well, my friend.
Yeah, good to have you back, Phil. It's been a couple of years since you've been on the show, and this new book is really excellent, a fully detailed account of your experiences and an invaluable resource on this critically important historical question. You know, I mean, I got involved in politics, which wasn't my original plan after being witch-hunted out of the academy for looking into 9/11. And the more I look beneath the surface of that event, the more I see this kind of monstrous cover-up involving Zionist power in the United States that is very much a sort of a rehash of the Liberty. And so this is really important for people to know about. Unfortunately, most people still don't. Well, where should we start? Maybe Dave, you could say how you got involved with Phil and helped him get the book out.
Well, I had interviewed Phil several years ago. I would say probably the first interview might have been in 2010, 2011, and we did a nice interview on the Liberty and on his first book, What I Saw That Day. And then American Free Press had a free speech conference in Austin, Texas in 2012. And Phil was invited to that conference, and of course I went, and I had interviewed Phil in the run-up to the conference, excuse me, and then I met him actually in Austin, and there was another survivor there as well, Gary Brummett from Louisiana, and that was, so let's say that's 2012, and then Phil and I had spoken afterwards, not too frequently, just literally maybe once a year, I would think. And then in August of 2015, Phil had reached out to me. He had called me when I was relocating from the northeast part of the country to the southeast part of the country, and I was actually cruising through the mountains of Pennsylvania in the evening in a truck, and Phil called, and the upshot of the conversation was that he wanted to do something with his book that was already published or do something with a new book or get a new book going. Really didn't know quite exactly what he wanted to do, and he didn't. He just gave me a call, and we even talk about it to this day, and he just called me almost out of the blue, but he just had a feeling that I was the right guy to talk to. And so I told him, I said, well, you know, I'm extremely busy, and I really don't know how much time I would have to do anything like this. But it turned out that I did take a look in great detail at his book, What I Saw That Day. And I read it a couple of times, actually, and I started making notes, marking up the PDF, and at any rate, it got to the point where we had a new book on our hands, a completely new book, and with new information that wasn't in the previous book, new interviews with survivors, stuff that has never been revealed in any other book about the Liberty. And while we were doing that, and this took a year. So basically, I took a year out of my life to spend on the Liberty. I did other things, of course, my normal job and whatever else I do. But this actually took a full year of thorough research. And I learned so much about the Liberty that I didn't know, of course. And so I remember I asked Phil, I said, hey, you know, Phil, I remember there was some talk about, or somebody told me that there was maybe a movie in the works. And what's up with that? And he said, you know, I really don't know. There was a guy out in Australia who put together a screenplay. He spent quite a bit of time on it, interviewing Phil and a couple of the other survivors. And so I got the guy's name and number, and I called him up, and we spoke. And basically, I just wanted to find out what was the status of that. And the status of that was that nothing was happening. And so I thought that, well, you know, the 50th anniversary is coming up, and, well, hell, I'm not a movie maker, but I was never a radio host before either. And I always say that the great thing about this country is that if you want to do something, you can. Nobody's going to stop you. Of course, that's, you know, except for if you get up real high and you know, they'll kill you, like what they did to Kennedy in broad daylight and so many other people. But
well, they'll terrorize you into silence like they did with the Liberty survivors.
Exactly. Or do what they did to you, which is remove you from your position. As a professor.
So it's kind of a free country.
Yeah, it is. That's what I was saying. Until you get too high up there, you basically could do what you want. And so, I talked to this guy, found out there was really nothing happening, and I said, Phil, you know, the 50th anniversary is coming up. You know, I never made a movie before. I know you didn't, and you know, but let's put that on the agenda here. Let's try to do something. I mean, because if we don't do it now, it's never going to be done. I mean, it's bad enough that, you know, I use this term, and I believe it's accurate to use the unwashed masses. And the reason I think it's accurate to use is because I have talked to a lot of people. And I know that most people don't take the time to read. And I think reading is the most important thing that anyone can do, if they have the time to do it, of course. You know, a lot of people are struggling to just exist. I understand that. But you have to make time. You have to make some room in your life to read, because you cannot gain the information necessary to make the right decisions if you don't read. There's no substitute for reading. And usually in a good article, the best part of the article is literally at the end of the article, I've found. And so we came to the conclusion that the populace would most effectively be educated about the Liberty in the form of a full-length feature film. Not a narrative film, which is a fictional presentation of something, but a full-length feature film, a true story, this is accurate, that type of a film, not a documentary either. Mm-hmm. So we did the book, and we have been fundraising for the movie, and we actually last night I spent over an hour on the phone with a movie director and producer and actor who heard our interview on the Jeff Rentz show, and he came forward to assist in any way he possibly could. So there have been a lot of people literally around the world who have not just contributed to the film project in the way of donations, but they have contributed by a commitment of their time because they're in the film industry. So we have a lot of things in place here. All we need to do is secure enough funding to move forward, and we got ourselves a movie. And the idea is not to make any money off of it. We're not interested in that. We just want to get this story out. If we can get it on the silver screen, fine. If we can't, if we can get it on HBO, fine. If we can't, if we can get it on Netflix, fine. If we can't, we'll sell it over the internet or we'll put it on the internet. The point is, get the movie out there. People like to be entertained. They'll find out it's a true story. It's a significant historical event. If the Liberty is the most highly decorated ship in the history of the United States Navy for a single action, and nobody knows about it. So this historical event is not just significant because of that, but because of what happened in June of 1967, which the Liberty was a part of, plays a part in all of our lives, mostly in the form of the terrorism that was created by Israel's illegal land grab and the almost 50-year cover-up of the Liberty and the covering up for Israel's crimes by the United States government.
All right. Hey, have you talked to Merlin Miller by any chance? Because I know he's been interested in trying to do a Liberty project. He talked when I was in Tehran a couple of years ago. Merlin was there as part of the film festival. And there were people in Iran who were interested in even talking about the possibility of filming in Iran. And, you know, they have a great film industry over there. They make better movies per capita than any country on earth by a mile. They put Hollywood to shame. You know, the whole neorealism craze that's now going worldwide really got started in Iran 20, 30 years ago. So anyway, just a question. Do you know Merlin Miller?
Merlin and I are very close. I've stayed at his home once, and very beautiful people, him and his wife Susie and his daughters, and I'm very familiar with his involvement in the Liberty and the screenplay that he wrote called False Flags. And what Merlin's screenplay was about, and Merlin has already, obviously, as you know, Kevin, he's made movies. So he's actually made movies, but Merlin wrote False Flags without the battle scenes. And the reason he did primarily was because he was concerned that he wouldn't be able to raise enough funds to do those scenes justice. Now, of course, a lot has changed since Merlin wrote that in the sense of technology and CGI, computer-generated imagery. So what we want to do is, and I've talked to Merlin about this project at length as well, and what we want to do is we want to be able to get the fundraising from enough patriots, and there are a lot of supporters, like I said, overseas, UK, Australia, New Zealand, all over the world. And many of our big supporters are American Jews, which is great because we want people to know that this isn't a Jewish thing. This isn't a religious thing. This isn't something we want to go get the Jews or we want to get the Israelis. The worst part about this story is the U.S. government cover up, the way that the U.S. government treated these boys. Most of them were boys. So as far as Iran, and I know what you're saying because I've seen some of those films and they're way advanced. I mean, it's a joke. I mean, the U.S. film industry is a farce, but we haven't approached anyone over there, not saying that we wouldn't. And Merlin almost had funding available, but it was because they had a change of administrations. And just when it was about to happen, he might have told you this, it actually fell through. So, yeah, we're not averse to talking to anyone. anyone who is interested in going to USSLibertyMovie.com and reading about the project and clicking the donate tab and making a donation, we're more than happy to do that. You know, that's the whole idea. That's a plan. Whether it's $1, which people have donated $1, whether it's $5, $10, $50, $25, $100, $1,000, and people have done all different amounts. The money, and I've said this on interviews recently, the money is just sitting there, and that's what it does. It sits there. The only reason or the only way we use it is to buy books, because if somebody donates $25 from the U.S., then they would get a copy of the new book. If they donate $50, then they would get an autographed copy, $100, an inscribed copy. There are people who donate money, and they leave a note when they donate, and they say, keep the book, or don't send me the book, keep the money, make the movie, get this done. A lot of people are like that. They just literally get it done. It's got to be done. They have a sense that this story is so important to really the history, the survival of this republic, that they just want it done.
Right. That's what came up in the conversations in Iran, which featured a bunch of kind of, American patriots who are out of grace with the ruling powers here in the U.S., people like me and Merlin Miller and other folks from the U.S. and from around the world. And everybody agreed that somebody needs to do do justice to the Liberty story in the form of a movie. It would, and God willing, it will be an incredible movie. Well, Phil, let's bring you into the conversation, because this book is your story, and it's an amazing story. And you know, just of all of the things that jump out at me from this book, probably, you know, the first one is just how the absolute night and day difference between your experience of what happened and the truth that you guys have dug up, and what they told the world for years and decades and are even still telling the world. I mean, how could anybody have ever honestly believed that this was some kind of accident where the Israelis thought they were attacking an Egyptian ship that didn't look anything like this? I mean, the whole, it's ridiculous. It's almost as ridiculous as believing that those three skyscrapers in New York disappeared at free fall acceleration through the path of most resistance because of ordinary office fires kindled by kerosene. You know, how do they inflict these stories on us?
Kevin, you know, you bring up a lot of good points, and I'll try to get to all of them, but, you know, the last time we spoke, several years back, a lot of things have changed, as Dave has said, and a lot of digging up new material and thinking about this book as thoroughly and thoughtfully and meticulously as we could. We wanted everything perfect as we could get it. Of course, nobody's perfect, and you know, we're not. We're humans. We make mistakes. But in this book, we not like my last book, What I Saw That Day. Dave and I talked about it, and I said, "Hey, listen, Dave. What I want to do is get all the survivors that we can to tell their own story in their own words, because this you know, just isn't about me. It's about what happened to them too, and which." We have done, and we've uncovered many more secrets that people have never heard of before by great research, and I attribute that to Dave. Without his expertise and knowledge and commitment, and a strong commitment to the truth, as being a United States Navy sailor himself that served aboard submarines, USS Skate, he knows what goes on. And so we started there, and it just began to blossom and get bigger and bigger and bigger. And we've hit a lot of roadblocks, as all people do. But listen, like Dave said, we're not out to beat anybody up, but the truth is, Israel got by with cold-blooded, premeditated murder on American United Ships vessel that had been identified as the USS Liberty in international waters and attacked by the Zionist State of Israel with malice, forethought to sink us and murder us all, which they almost did, Kevin. And I think you've already read the book, and know exactly.
I'm almost 250 pages into it. It's amazing. And, you know, some of this stuff I either didn't remember or hadn't known before. Like, you know, for instance, the way they targeted so precisely, the wheelhouse, the machine gun mounts, the antennas, each watertight hatch, every antenna on board was hit, every life raft station, they hit the captain's gig. So this, this was something that this shows that not only did they know they were hitting a U.S. ship, they knew they were attacking the Liberty. They had the plans of the Liberty available to hit all those things. This was something I had never known before.
Absolutely. That's exactly, you explained it perfectly. As what we wanted in the book was no BS, Kevin. We wanted the exact truth and to bring it out into the light of the American people where they can read it and they can understand it and they can understand why this is so important to their survival, the American survival, our way of life.
And they attack our ship. As Dave said, it's the real scandal here is the cover up by American traitors. But what that reveals is that these American traitors have to cover this up on behalf of Israel. Tells us something very important about the power of Israel in the United States, which is linked to so many of the problems we've got right now.
Oh, absolutely, Kevin. I mean, you know the real deal. You're a smart man. You've been there. You know exactly what the heck's going on. And you were talking about Merlin Miller. Yeah, I've had Merlin and Susie up to my house. They stayed here a while, and great people. And when we get this movie done, and we will get it done by hook or crook, we will get this movie done because we don't give up. We're not quitters. We're people that believe in the Constitution of the United States. We believe in supporting the servicemen and women of this country. But we also believe in uncovering this wretched cover-up that has been going on for the last 50 years, Kevin. And, you know, the USS Liberty is not the first dirty cover-up these guys are into, all for the Zionist State of Israel. Now, you talked about the Congress, I believe, and how easy it is for them to be bought and paid for, which they are, all of them are. I don't care if they're Republican or Democrats or the dog catcher at the White House. If you don't support Israel, you're down the road, and that's just a fact. Ask Pete McCluskey and so many others that have been run off because of their support for the truth. And not supporting the Zionist state, they're out of office. So basically, $100,000 buys these guys off. A measly $100,000 buys them off, letting the Zionist state of Israel get by with cold-blooded murder. 34 Americans were slaughtered. I mean, blown to bits, Kevin. Blown to bits by our so-called ally in international waters. And our government knew they were doing this to us. They knew it. We got a message out. Terry Haldabardier hooked to coaxial cable to an antenna that they took off flying, and he got working. And within 15 or so minutes, you know, we got an SOS out, rockstar, rockstar, under attack by unknown jet aircraft. Unknown jet aircraft. Well, We knew that morning and the day before that who was surveilling our ship with the Star of David on their airplanes. Very clearly, they would come by our ship as low as they could and wave and smile and all this other BS when they were taking pictures or whatever else they could do to murder us. And we felt great about it. Kevin. We felt great. Our best friends in the whole wide world were there to protect our ship in case something happened, because we could see the rockets and bombs going off and on the coast. We knew we were in the war zone, but we were in international waters. So we had nothing to fear because our flag was our shield. By the way, they called Captain McGonagall wanted a destroyer escort or a destroyer to stay with us just in case something happened. And he was denied that, saying, don't worry about it. You have no problem. Your banner is your flag. The United States of America will protect you. So that didn't happen. In my view, and a lot of the people disagree with me or agree, we were set up. Mm-hmm. I mean, they knew we were under attack 15 minutes after the attack or so, and sent jetter aircraft off to Saratoga by a war hero, Captain Joe Tully, a fighter pilot during World War II. He not only sent one volley, he sent two. And one of them was recalled by McNamara, then Johnson, however it worked out. They recalled the aircraft when we were under severe and dire straits of all of us dying. And he said he would not embarrass his ally Israel, and he could give a GD if every man went down with that ship. He was not going to embarrass Israel. Now, how did he know it was Israel who was attacking us when we didn't know? We didn't know who was attacking us until the torpedo boats got there. And in fact, we thought the torpedo boats were there to help us, and they were there to finish the job and sink us. So you're talking about a bunch of backstabbing SOBs, not only
right,
Israel,
right up to the
but
president.
The United States of America. Absolutely, yeah. And it's still that way, Kevin. From Johnson up to Trump, they know truth, but they're still covering up.
A lot of people would say that the power of Israel in the United States, as revealed in the Liberty incident and its cover up, is very relevant to the extreme disappointment many people have felt about the Trump presidency so far. That Trump's moves. That, you know, all of Trump's bad moves, from, you know, putting, you know, basically turning over the finances to Goldman Sachs, you know, to going to visit Saudi Arabia, which is a very close ally of Israel, and then Israel itself, and basically to be attacking the government of Syria and joining the Saudi-sponsored and Israeli-sponsored terrorists and trying to overthrow Syria. All these things that have disappointed Trump supporters have a lot to do with the power of Israel to force the president of the United States to do whatever Israel wants him to do.
Exactly. And you know, Kevin, when he was at the, they call it the Western Wall now, but it's really the Wailing Wall. And he said a prayer there and stuck in a message. I would hope that message would have said, please God forgive me for covering up the murderous attack on the USS Liberty, and forgive Israel for their dirty deeds. I doubt that's what he said, but you know, you got to put the blame where blame is due, and the blame is on the United States of America for covering up for murderers who attacked our ship. Not only with unmarked jet aircraft, but dropping napalm on our ship and over 850 cannon and rocket holes in our ship, over 5,000 armor-piercing bullets in our ship, a 40-by-40-foot hole in the starboard side, and the torpedo boats, when we put over the life rafts, and I cut one over of them off myself, it inflated. And they shot it out of the water. We were going to put our most wounded in them, hopefully to save their lives. That was not going to happen. The brutality.
Wow. It's machine gunning life rafts. That's insane.
It's a war crime, and we already filed it with the Department of the Army a war crimes report. They threw it in the shit can, as they do everything else when it comes to Israel. It's, you know, Israel could do no wrong. They got their fingers, their thumb on the Congress, as well as any other leaders, and probably more than we know of, Kevin, and Dave can attest to this, around the world. So if they're willing to give up American lives to appease the Zionist murderers that killed my shipmates and tried to murder me, I've written to everybody. I've called the FBI. I've called the CIA. I've called the National Security Agency. And I said, listen, I'm going to report a crime here of cold-blooded premeditated murder, and I want you to do something about it. There's no statute of limitations on murder, especially from, I don't care if it's Israel or Cuba. I don't give a damn who it is. Murder is murder. And, as far as I'm concerned, we're still at war with the Zionist State of Israel for what they did, not only to the crew of the USS Liberty, but to the United States of America and their citizens. Because when they attacked our ship, they attacked you, Kevin. They attacked you, David. And they talked, they attacked every American alive today, and they got by with it. And they're still continuing to get by with their Zionist lies and the cover up with them and the United States of America. I've repeated myself, but I'll tell you what, this fires me up. I'm 70 years old now. I'm going to keep on doing this as long as I'm alive to make sure that the truth is told. And with this book that Dave and I put together, and I have to tell you, Kevin, with all the honesty I can put in my heart, without Dave Gahari and his excellent skills, my book would not be out there today. So I give all the credit to Dave. My name's on the book, but I'll tell you, he did everything in his power to make this book as powerful as it is. And he's a great friend of mine, and God bless him for what he's done. And we will continue to get this done. Go to USS Liberty movie.com, USS Liberty movie.com. Learn all about it. Order a book. Make a donation, as Dave said. And we are going to get this done one way or another, Kevin. And with people like you, I know we will, and I certainly appreciate it.
Well, you're on the right track, Phil. And, you know, I have to agree with you that this book is a you know, your earlier book was good. It was a very moving and important book. But this is a huge improvement. I mean, this is a really, you know, this is even better. And this could be the book that helps blow things wide open. Well, before we turn it back to Dave, Phil, you know, one of the really moving things about this book is the, well, what you saw, as the title of your earlier book puts it, was so intense and so, you know, so moving with these acts of amazing heroism where James Terry Halbardier, he manages to patch together a coaxial cable to the antenna that had been dead, which is why it didn't get hit. They hit all the live ones and get off that message that, according to some interpretations, might have saved the world from nuclear holocaust, because there's a question of launching U.S. aircraft with nuclear bombs to hit Russian installations in Egypt. And according to some information, that actually were launched and recalled just before they got out of range. So, I mean, that's an amazing story, an amazing act of heroism. Your heroism, you know, trying to help the wounded guys, and so on, and the, you know, hell that you went through is very graphically, movingly described in this book. But, you know, this nightmare you went through, Phil, it goes from, you know, from one stage to another when you describe, what happened, you know, after the ship didn't sink. And you go to, was it Malta, I guess, and there, you know, after, you know, you're expecting that this is going to be dealt with properly and honorably, and instead you get Admiral Kidd telling you, don't talk to your shipmates, don't talk to your family, don't talk to your friends, don't talk to the guy at the bar about what happened. If you do, you'll be court-martialed, or worse. And that was the start of a whole new nightmare, wasn't it?
Absolutely, Kevin. And, you know, I didn't speak about the Liberty for, 20 years or so until after the attack. In fact, I even forgot what day it was. Believe me, that's what Admiral Kidd did to me. He put the fear of God in me. And then all of a sudden I read an article by a shipmate, Stan White, in the Rocky Mountain News, which is now defunct. But I read that article and I says, wow, man, finally somebody's speaking up. So that's when I really got involved. And ever since then, I've been doing this. And Kevin, the ironic and terrible injustice done to America, I'm not just talking about the crew of the Liberty, America, is that this message that we were being attacked by Israel went out all over the world. It went to Vietnam. It went to Morocco. Everywhere. They heard it. And then they said that, it was a mistaken identity. But also what is even more disgusting than that is we could have sent out 10,000 messages 2 minutes after the attack to the United States Navy, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, the Army, the Cub Scouts, the Girl Scouts. We're never going to get any help. So it made no difference. I mean, yes, the call got out. The call did get out. We were under attack by unmarked jet aircraft. But it made no difference. They were never going to send help to us anyway. Never. We didn't see an American ship until 18 hours after the attack. So that conclusion there right there is that they wanted us to sink at night with all hands aboard. And story over. Jesus, poor old Israel, doggone it. They tried to help us or this, that, and the other. But those no good Arabs sunk this ship with 294 souls, Americans, in international waters. Now, guess what would have happened? America would demanded blood. Absolutely, they would demanded blood, and they would have got plenty of it. So that's what they wanted. They wanted our ship to sink.
Johnson was part of this, and he actually Don Engen's testimony in the book shows that not just McNamara but Johnson himself was personally ordering the help to not come. He was basically standing down and trying to, let the Israelis kill you guys.
Absolutely, Kevin. They didn't even send a Piper Cub over to see how we were doing. They sent no aircraft, nothing, zero. And it was very clear to us when that happened that we were on our own. There were so many miraculous things that happened, post-attack, during the night operations, trying to keep people alive, plugging holes, and until we, the next morning, like I say, 18 hours afterwards, we were forgotten. Just like we were on the front page one day and the back page the next, we were forgotten. And that's why I never spoke about it for 20 years. When I married my second wife, my beautiful second wife, by the way, her birthday's on the 29th, Memorial Day, I never told her a thing about it. Never, because I was afraid to. And then when this came out, I told her. And from that moment forward, she has supported me 1,000,000% and written letters that, of which I can't spell very good, but she can, and she would take care of it. I sent him to Congress over and over and over again. This went on for years and years and years, and finally I figured out, Jesus, what a dummy I am, because I finally figured out exactly what the real deal was. But Kevin, as I said, this movie is not just about the USS Liberty; it's about protecting the rights of Americans and not be under the thumb of a Zionist state and have our congressmen and senators bow down to them and kiss their feet at the altar every time Netanyahu comes to the United States or vice versa. So it's a very, very big story. It's a huge story. And it's our obligation.
It's a key to ending the war on terror, too, isn't it? See, I mean, that we're in the middle of this so-called war on terror, which is all about, right, 9/11. We're told that it was the evil Arab radical extremists that attacked us, but all indications are that it was actually very much like the Liberty, traitors here in the U.S. And Israel, designed to suck the U.S. into a 100 years war against Israel's enemies. I mean, that's basically what's going on. And all of these post 9/11 false flags, with Manchester the most recent, the closer you look at those, the more it looks like we've got an Israeli assisted, maybe Gladio B program going on, where these are false flags. I mean, the guy they're blaming for Manchester, which I'll be talking about in the second hour, worked for this Libyan outfit that's basically a bunch of mercenaries working for British intelligence, and presumably along they're helping out the Israeli plan for the Middle East. You know, they tried to kill Gaddafi, then they overthrew him, and now this guy who worked for the British basically is blowing people up in a concert. So this Liberty incident is so important for understanding where we are now. You know, there's this pattern here from the Lavan incident in the early 1950s, when the Israelis attacked American targets in Egypt and tried to make it look like it was the Egyptians that did it, and they got caught, that they protested for decades that it was an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory to say that the Israelis did it, even though the Egyptians got them convicted in court. And then it was just not that many years ago when Israel finally admitted that they bombed American targets in Egypt intentionally with the intent of blaming the Egyptians. And they had a big ceremony and gave medals to the guys who organized that. And, you know, next thing you know, they're going to be giving medals to the guys who attacked the Liberty, and, you know, maybe medals to the guys who blew up the World Trade Center someday. You know, it's at some point we have to put our foot down, and your story could be a really important part of that. And, you know, Dave, what were some of the most important issues or, you know, new pieces of information that hadn't been in other books? You know, I've read Phil's earlier book. I've read the Peter Hunnam book, Operation Cyanide, and various things on the internet about this. But it seems to me that I'm encountering a lot of new information in this book. Can you know, give us a couple of examples of really important new pieces of information?
Sure, Kev. Yes. Really, I think the most overriding, and let me just say that, you know, there's that saying that it's easy to criticize a giant when you're standing on his shoulders. Well, this information that was garnered for the book was, a lot of it was based on other people who had written about the Liberty. So as you know from reading the book, and you're only a couple of pages, you know, from the end, because I think it's like 276 pages, this one. But a lot of the information was from the hard work and dedication of other people. And then my knowledge of the Liberty and my knowledge of matters that weren't related to the Liberty, like terrorism, like the fact that prior to Israel's illegal land grab, the only terrorism that existed in the United States was from Puerto Ricans. And I think that that's something very important for people to realize, is that because of this incident, which isn't the proper term for the Liberty, this attack, this 6-day war, because of what transpired there, we are still dealing with, as Phil said, as you said, as I said, with the fallout, the repercussions from their illegal land grab, is what has created so much misery in the world. That's not new information, but it's put into the context that I think will benefit the world in the future when this movie does come out. The testimony from people who were there, Liberty survivors, shed a lot of light on the actions of the captain. And you read the chapter on Captain McGonagall. There's pretty heavy evidence that the captain made a deal with the devil.
Yeah, it looks like they got to him ahead of time. and or rather got to him afterwards, although there's some question about some of his connections ahead of time, too, as I recall from Peter Hunnam's book. But, yeah, he ended up supporting the ridiculous Israeli cover story.
Exactly, and he altered logs. That's never been in a book. Another significant part of the book is the fact that, and for some reason this isn't covered in other books, is the fact that obviously at the time of the attack on the Liberty, the United States and the Soviet Union were knee-deep in the Vietnam War. And the U.S. and the Soviet Union were making deals because of Israel's illegal land grab, which they both knew about. And they had the Soviets had approached the U.S. and said, look, you have Israel back off, and then we'll back off in Vietnam. And that, in fact, did happen. And, of course, the corporate-controlled criminal mainstream media didn't even cover that, as you read about, Kevin. And the fact that if Israel would have continued with its illegal land grab, and they were supposed to actually even go to Damascus, that the Soviet Union was prepared to drop troops in Syria to stop Israel. So Israel really, and U.S. officials have said this, that Israel brought the world closer to the brink of war than had happened during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So it seems like their only concern, their attitude is we come first, and you know, the hell with the fallout. Now there's some controversy, as Phil alluded to, and you had too, Kevin, about why did they go after the Liberty? Well, I believe, and of course the readers can come to any conclusion they want. I'm not concerned about that, but I believe that the decision to sink the Liberty, and it was a clear decision, and that's the main theme of the book, is that, as you said, Kevin, there was no mistake. They even, and you read about this, they even admitted, the Israelis who were involved in the attack even admitted that they knew it was an American ship. So there is no controversy. That's something very important. There is no controversy. They'll say the ADL and the SPLC and these other Jewish organizations, American Jewish organizations and international Jewish organizations, will throw around that anti-Semitic nonsense and say this is a conspiracy theory. And that's something that really angers me, because how dare you say that the attack on the Liberty was a conspiracy theory when the Israelis themselves admitted that they knew it was an American ship. So they're disrespecting and dishonoring these poor people who had to go through this attack, who still live with it 50 years later today. And all they're looking for is justice. That's it. So.
Yeah. And they've been muzzled and harassed and terrorized, as Phil mentioned. And, you know, one story in the book that I hadn't heard about was how Don Engen, he was I guess on the America that was going to come to the aid of the Liberty. And then he was apparently involved when McNamara and then Johnson ordered them not to come to the aid of the Liberty. And, Don apparently spoke out of turn a few times. And you mentioned in the book that it was right before he was going to be giving an interview on this, that he died in a freak glider accident. The book suggests that that may not have been an accident, and that there may be other people from the Liberty who got suicided.
Oh, Phil, knows much more about this than I do, because he actually was, he played a big part in that documentary where, as you mentioned, Don Engen died, which was very mysterious. But there were also, and this is important, Kevin, I don't think this was in the book, but there were two serious attempts already made to put together a movie. And both of the people, both of the men who tried to do that, died. And Phil can tell you. Yeah, Phil can tell you.
Maybe you guys should buy some life insurance just to discourage that kind of thing. You know, if you get a big enough life insurance policy and make sure that the proceeds go to making a movie about the Liberty, then that should discourage them from any funny business. I think I'm going to donate some money just so you guys can do that.
No, that's actually a very smart point. You know, Phil and I were just we're crazy. You know, people think we're nuts, and it's funny. You know, he's 70, I'm 57. You know, we were both in the Navy in different areas of the Navy, but there's something about, and I've said this before, there's something about when you meet somebody else in the Navy, there is this bond. I don't know what it's about, but there definitely is this bond. We're very close. We've gotten very close. We've actually traveled around the country speaking to groups about the book and the movie, and we're about to do it some more coming up this summer and fall and winter. We're going all over the place. And Phil really, I mean, he said, you know, he couldn't do it without me. I understand what he's saying, but here's a guy who he never gives up. And I said this before in another interview. This is a guy who could literally, because he's done it, he could drive from his home in Colorado all the way to the east coast of Virginia without stopping, nonstop. I'm not kidding. So you can imagine how he did the things he did aboard the Liberty during that attack. And he just didn't stop. He didn't sleep. He's a great man, a great American, and all he wants to do is get the truth out. And he's not going to rest until that happens. And if it wasn't for him, and I've told him this, of course, and he knows this, then I wouldn't be doing it, because this guy gives me the strength to do it. And as he said, I'm certain, Kevin, that we are going to do it. There's nothing that's going to stop us. And frankly, I'm not afraid of somebody trying to stop us. You know, if something did happen, okay, but I really don't think it's going to, because there's nothing controversial about the story about the Liberty. They admitted that they knew it was American. They admitted that. There's nothing controversial. All we have to do is get the money, and it's a done deal.
Well, I don't think what they're worried about is the controversy. What they're worried about is that a really good movie about the Liberty could have a pretty major effect. Now, there is, however, there's definitely a split here in the American Jewish community right now between the hardline Zionists behind Netanyahu and the people like Blumenthal's and various other liberal Jewish elite types, who are pretty much probably the majority of American Jews is really uncomfortable with the land grab, the settlements, you know, the way the 67 war of aggression that was designed to steal all that land has turned out, with more than 500,000 illegal settlers squatting on land that the entire world says belongs to Palestine, not Israel. And so in that situation, with a growing sentiment, especially among Jews living outside of Israel, that this situation is an embarrassment and that there has to be some kind of way of dealing with it, whether a two-state solution, which looks increasingly unrealistic, or maybe some kind of, you know, move towards a one-state solution. In any case, the number of sane and reasonable and better informed Jewish voices in the West is one cause for hope. And I would think that many of, you know, that side of the equation would actually probably not object to a Liberty movie. On the contrary, it might actually help their case. It's a very interesting situation. You know, you could conceivably actually end up with people helping it. We know that people of Jewish ethnicity dominate the Hollywood and the film industry, and traditionally have been very biased in favor of Israel. But, you know, we can always hope that that's going to change, and that the Sheldon Adelsons of this world are going to start losing out to the Max Blumenthals. And, you know, Max Blumenthal has his downsides too, but there's a serious improvement there. And then there are more and more, like, really truth-speaking Jewish people out there really calling it the way they see it. So, you know, I think gradually things are changing, and the truth is what changes things. And you guys are really doing yeoman's work to get the truth out. So thank you so much for this great new book. The book is called Erasing the Liberty, and the authors are Phil Turney, the Liberty Survivor, and Dave Gary. I appreciate you guys coming on. Keep up the great work. God bless, and let's get that movie made.
You, Kevin.
Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate it.
Okay. Take care, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So this is Truth Jihad Radio, back next hour to talk about the Manchester event with Ian Greenhall, who will be joining us live at 2 in the morning local time from pretty close to Manchester. Stay tuned. Every Friday evening. So please do keep Revolution Radio going. Go to freedomslips.com and kick in what you can. And while you're at it, feel free to subscribe to my shows over at truthjihad.com. Well, I think we just heard a bunch of reasons to think that the cover-ups of various horrific events that may have some Israeli fingerprints on them are a serious problem, an ongoing problem, from the Levon affair through the Liberty incident discussed in the first hour to today's war on terror. There is a pattern here. And we're going to talk about a recent example of this pattern with Ian Greenhall. Ian Greenhall is in the UK. He's staying up late tonight just so he can join the show to talk about the Manchester event. And we'll compare notes on that. I think we're pretty much on the same page, but let's find out. Hey, welcome, Ian Greenhall. How are you?
Hi, Kevin. How are you? I'm pretty good.
I'm well. I appreciate your staying up till 2 in the morning local time to do this.
Well, it's really hot and sticky here at the moment, so I've been napping most of the day.
Right. Well, that's good then. I may be doing the same thing too, because it's Ramadan, and Ramadan Kareem to my Muslim listeners, and sometimes my schedule shifts a little bit towards night owlish kinds of of lifestyles during Ramadan, depending, of course, on how much I have to get done during the day, even when I'm lightheaded and all of that. But so Ian, you're over.
Kevin, by the
way,
what day did Ramadan start this year?
Well, it's probably starting tomorrow. I'm not, you know, it's hard to tell these days who is officially in charge of saying it's Ramadan and it's not Ramadan, because it has to do with the moon. See, if there's a moon sighting, then the month starts. It's a lunar month. And there are differences of opinion sometimes on, you know, who has seen the moon or who's a qualified observer to have seen the moon. And then there are those who say, oh, let's just go by the astronomical calendars. But the big problem with that is those people are all being paid off by the Saudis. So basically then the Saudis declare when it's Ramadan, and many of us don't particularly care for taking orders from the Saudis. I mean, it's bad enough when people are taking orders from the Saudis and taking huge piles of money to do it, but taking orders from the Saudis for free about when you have to start fasting, this is ridiculous. In any case, we're expecting Ramadan, or the first day of fasting, to start tomorrow, which means the month of Ramadan is starting almost exactly now where I am, because it's sunset.
The reason why I asked was I wondered if it had already begun on the 22nd, because it would be very un-Islamic to do any kind of act like that during Ramadan. It's strictly prohibited, isn't it?
One would think. I mean,
you're warfare during Ramadan.
Right. Yeah, it's certainly much preferable. Well, but the thing is, it's so completely ludicrously un-Islamic to be slaughtering civilians anyway, that, you know, whether it's Ramadan or not isn't really the issue.
Yeah.
And that leads to this question of, you know, how is it that Islam, which has these very, very strong rules against mistreating civilians and even harming property, and, you know, throughout history there have been Muslim leaders that kept to that better than others. And then the Muslim populations of the world oppose terrorism far more than non-Muslim populations. You know, major difference. Polls show that it's like 20 percentage points, 30 percentage points difference in the polls when they ask, is it okay to target civilians? Muslims say no, far more than non-Muslims do. So this whole notion that Muslims like to attack civilians is completely ridiculous. And, you know, if there are really angry Muslims out there who are going to pick up arms, they're going to be going after Tony Blair and Bush and Cheney and people like that, which wouldn't be that hard. I mean, there are these really nasty neocons who slaughtered millions of Muslims who go out on book tours. You know, it's like, how hard would it be to hit a couple of those guys? But no, all we see is these mass slaughters of civilians that only make Islam look bad. They make Muslims look bad. They keep the war on terror going. They help the Israelis. You know, any actual angry Muslim who did anything like this would be a complete idiot who should be executed to take him out of the gene pool to save the gene pool as an intelligence genes. But in any case, So Ian, how far are you away from Manchester?
As the crow flies, about 90 miles.
Okay.
My family, my dad's side, the family are from Manchester.
Really?
I still have friends and family there. I mean, culturally it is the same as where I live. You know, we are, you know, it's the nearest large city. I've spoken to quite a few people in Manchester, and you ask three different people, you get three different opinions. That this has been a very divisive issue in some ways. I mean, yeah, the entire community has come together, which is a good thing. But people are arguing like cat and dog about what happened. And I think that what the reason why is that right from the get-go, there are, regardless of the actual events, layered on top are layers of PSYOP to confuse everybody. Just like Sandy Hook. So that very quickly the dialogue has shifted from, you know, the sensible to people arguing about, you know, crisis actors and, you know, the supposed suicide bomber's bank card. Well, you know, people say, oh, for it to have survived in his pocket, it must have been made of titanium. And people say, no, that's stupid. So it's very much the divide and conquer thing working on multiple levels. That, you know, they never, you're saying, you know, that the targets that they choose, they never go after the politicians or the bigwigs or the people who are actually responsible for bombing and attacking Muslim countries, which is a big giveaway that it's not on the level. But the whole reason for targeting children is that it makes the discussion on a much higher level emotively, so that the people who dare to question it are going to get absolutely roasted by nearly everybody else, because, you know, they have that knee-jerk Pavlovian reaction of, oh, how dare you disrespect those dead children and their poor families. So
already
we are seeing, you know, the effects of all of the obfuscation and psyop that they're spinning around this, and probably we will never get any closer to the actuality of what happened than we were at the beginning. Because as this spinning atop of disinformation picks up speed, it starts taking on more and more material. So that before too long, anybody who really wants to study it is going to struggle, because they've got to fight through a mass of misinformation, and often it's people, some of this information is created by people who have good intentions, but just, you know, they wear tinfoil hats. And so it's supposed to, if I wanted to know now the truth about Sandy Hook, I would have to spend weeks or months studying it and filtering out all of the deliberate MacGuffins and red herrings. And I see exactly the same thing happening already with Manchester. So, you know, what we know now is probably as much as we'll ever know in terms of truth. And any subsequent knowledge that we can glean, it's like trying to find, you know, a needle in a haystack, because nearly everything that's going to be disclosed from now on in is not going to be right.
Well, that's why I was able to put out instant books about the Charlie Hebdo attack in January 2015, and then the following November attack in Paris, and then the Orlando attack. In all those cases, I had actual books out with contributions from a lot of great people, a total of 55 leading public intellectuals. And it wasn't, you know, I go back and look at these books. I had the first one, the Charlie Hebdo book, was out 6 weeks after the Charlie Hebdo event. And it's still really about as solid as you could possibly do today. Now, why would that be? Normally, you would think that it would take time to sort things through. But as you say, Ian, they put a lid on it. You know, these are state-sponsored false flag events, and they litter the ground with false clues. And they clamp down so that, you know, new damning information is unlikely to come out. So it's right when the event happens that most of the anomalies show up that show you that it's a false flag. So these instant books where you crank something out right away that actually stand the test of time, as I think my false flag trilogy has, you know, is actually not as crazy as it might sound. You know, a lot of folks, like, you know, they say, well, David Ray Griffin, he took, you know, several years to get on the case with 9/11. And then he worked on 9/11 for a decade and basically wrote the book or a series of books, more than a dozen books on 9/11. That's one way to do it. But given that, as you say, they're not going to let solid new information come out, they're just going to confuse us more and more and more with false clues, that maybe we can focus hard on these events when they happen, come up with the best interpretation that we can right after they happen, and then just say, you know, it's not going to be a long-term project because we're not going to have anything else good to work with in the future.
Yeah, and for that very reason, I myself haven't done any more than superficial study of the events, and I don't intend to. I'm going to leave that to the people who actually enjoy studying these events. I'm going to content myself with analysing the where's and why's around it. For me, the overriding why is the fact that we've got a general election next week, and Jeremy Corbyn is not going to be allowed to win.
Yes.
Hell or high water. And as I said to you, and you mentioned in your article on VT, the Corbyn's support is very strong among the young. And I think that is the largest part of why they chose to target young people. The other part of it being, it adds an extra level of emotion to it. But I think that it's worked. I mean, I got really, really disheartened the day after. I got really annoyed. I just shut myself off from the world for the day. I didn't want to talk to anybody, especially locally, because they've ended up slapping them. Because the amount of sheer ignorance and latent racism that was on display just was soul-destroying. You know, I could look on Facebook at what all the people that I actually know, most of them local to me, were saying about it, and I could go, yeah, you're a racist. I don't know who you are, but you're just definitely dumb. Yeah, and it's just stupid. Yeah, and the next time somebody says to me, dirty Muslim, or let's kill these scum, I'm going to punch them. And yeah. I'm a violent person, but it's just driving me that way. And I think that's, it made me realise the day after, hang on a minute, if this has got to me like that, then it just makes me realise that that's one of the parts of it. Just sow division. To, you know, the people that are among the non-Muslim population, as well as between the Muslims and the non-Muslims. Because in the non-Muslim population, they're sowing division between those who say, hang on a minute, we should look at this more closely in order to find the real culprits, and those who say, oh, you can't possibly disrespect those poor dead children. And I'm not going to say word one to anybody locally about this, because I'll get my windows smashed in. That is the strength of the feeling that exists. I mean, my poor mother was sat in front of the TV crying. And he cannot challenge that level of response by saying, oh, you know, it's a load of rubbish, or anything like that. Yet you say any word of doubt about this, and you're going to get in, you know, you are going to run into serious conflict with people over this. But it's clever, and it works on multiple levels, and I'm finding it soul-destroying because I am watching it work right in front of my eyes. They have just swung the election to make sure Theresa May gets elected. And all they had to do was blow 24 kids up.
Yeah, yeah. And this follows exactly what happened in France as well. A series of false flags with a big one in Paris leading up to the first round of the election. They obviously wanted to, they knew who they wanted and who they didn't want in office there. And it seems like it's almost becoming a pattern. It's kind of surprising in a way that they didn't do something quite like that in the U.S. election. Although it's, you know, how that election may have been swung or not swung is still up for debate. But here now we've seen two leading, you know, Western European countries, well, besides Germany, have just had these elections that have been essentially stolen through, you know, mass carnage. And I guess the people you're talking about who were reacting sort of primally, you know, with this kind of, you know, Neanderthal rally round the big caveman, or in this case, cavewoman with the club syndrome, are pretty much just unaware of the fact that, for example, this Libyan so-called terror group that this guy was affiliated with, actually is working in cahoots with MI6. I mean, they were trying to kill Gaddafi for MI6, as David Shaler revealed years and years ago, and the same group was involved in the overthrow of Gaddafi, supported by British and French and U.S. intelligence. So he's on our side, and of course, this kind of screws up the narrative. Like, wait a minute, why would a Libyan anti-Gaddafi guy who's basically fighting for the British, why would he be angry at the British and blow up British people? That makes no sense at all. Just like here with the Boston bombing, with these Chechen brothers accused of doing the Boston bombing, that makes no sense either, because the U.S. has been supporting the Chechens, including sort of the radical Muslim quote-unquote faction, the Salafi-backed faction over there, against the Russians. So they Chechens should be blowing up Russians, and I guess they occasionally do with the help of the CIA, but it makes no sense to have angry Chechens blowing up the Boston Marathon. It makes no sense whatsoever, any more than it makes sense to have, you know, the MI6 Libyans blowing up British people. I mean, how can people swallow this stuff?
I don't think a lot. I think I'm seeing that a lot of people haven't. Because a lot of people are, like I say, I was looking at what people I know in Manchester were saying today, and they're arguing like hell over it. Yeah, I don't think it's split 50-50, but there are enough people questioning it that it's at an almost unprecedented level of scepticism for one of these events. I don't remember seeing anything like this amount of scepticism over 7-7 or over Lee Rigby. I think the problem is, if you keep doing these same tricks over and over again, eventually, some people are going to get wise to it. And they're not really, the people are not really wise to the underlying machinations like we are, but they're wise to it in that they can, something tells them, their spider sense tells them, there's something not right here. And I'm getting the impression that more and more people with this event are saying, hang on a minute. What's really gone on here? Why has this happened now? And what is the real reason for it? And I don't think many of those people have any idea of the real answers. All they have is this unsettling sense that it's all not kosher, for want of a better term.
Well, the mainstream media is pushing back against that. And we're seeing some real breakthroughs with, for instance, a CNN analyst, Paul Cruikshank, actually raised the possibility of this being a false flag. And what's more, he actually said on CNN that there have been a number of false flags by right-wing groups in Europe falsely attributed to Muslims. And there's really only one that's officially accepted, which is the recent German plot that was uncovered. So Cruikshank appeared to be talking about the events analyzed in my false flag trilogy. Maybe he's reading my false flag trilogy. Anyway, having CNN calling this a possible false flag right as it's happening is a breakthrough. And then having Alex Jones at InfoWars join people like Pam Geller in attacking CNN for doing that and bashing the evil Muslims, go back to sleep people. I mean, this is the world has turned upside down, but I think that CNN still has a bigger audience than Alex does. And it's interesting that the mainstream has had to try to push back so hard against these so-called conspiracy theories. You know, the people on Twitter, there was a Labor candidate tweeting about how convenient this was for May, and then the media pushed back against her. It does seem like there's a real controversy here. And it's interesting also that the guy they're trying to stop with this false flag, Jeremy Corbyn, is a 9/11 Truth supporter. He was a very, very close friend of Michael Meacher, a leading British 9/11 truther, who then died mysteriously just as he was pushing for an independent UK investigation.
Michael Meacher. He was a senior politician for a long time, and he was a good man.
Right. Corbyn seems to be a good man, too, and maybe too good of a man for them to allow to occupy high office.
Of course. I mean, the whole thing about calling him an anti-Semite is just ridiculous. His favourite place to eat is a Jewish deli. You know, he has rabbi friends, you can go back and look. There are pictures of him with his rabbi friends going back 20 years. The whole reason for calling him an anti-Semite is because the British establishment, which is controlled by the Zionists, does not want him anywhere near power. And this is not the first time this has happened. This is not, by far, not the first time that the British establishment, using their propaganda arm, the BBC, and their malfeasance arm, the security services, to undermine and ultimately destroy a strong Labour leader. I mean, they did it to Neil Kinnock, they did it to Michael Foote, they did it to James Callaghan, they did it to Harold Wilson. They probably even tried to do it to Clement Attlee in the 1940s. I mean, to this day, there are still a lot of people who believe the guff about Harold Wilson having been a KGB agent. I mean, for God's sake.
Hey, remind me, which year was that happening? Was that in the 70s?
I believe it was.
I think I was there. You know, I weirdly, when I was 15 years old in 1974, my father was invited to speak in Australia about sailboat racing. And so I was able to take a semester off from high school and travel around the world with him. And so we went through Australia, where Jeff Whitlam was just about to be overthrown. He was a labor leader in Australia who wanted to close the Alice Springs CIA base. And so he was overthrown in a coup d'etat by the governor general, who was with the old boys CIA network. And I was there right before Whitlam was overthrown, hanging out with these extremely wealthy sailors, the guys, you know, the kind of guys who had invited my dad. It was called the Royal Sydney Yacht Squadron. And I still remember hearing those people bitching about Jeff Whitlam and, you know, chortling about how he was soon going to be gone. And then, you know, sure enough, a few months later, he was. And then on the way home, we went around the world by way of, we landed in Moscow, but didn't get off the plane, ended up in the UK. And my father had these, you know, he worked with a sail off. North Sails was the name of the business, and there was one there in the UK. So once again, we were talking with kind of the sailing people, which includes a fair number of pretty wealthy types. And they were, as I recall, really angry at, I think it was Wilson. They were angry at the Labour government, which was, they felt, taxing them exorbitantly. The sailing business was booming, though, because everybody was putting their money into sailboats and sailing them out of the UK to points where they could be, basically, the money in them could be disappeared. It was tax evasion. So anyway, I got to hang out with these people who were essentially, you know, the base of support for the folks who were overthrowing Labour governments in both the UK and Australia. And this was all when I was 15 years old, and I had no idea that I would be looking back on this from the perspective I look at it now.
Well, Wilson had two terms as Prime Minister in the 60s and the 70s. And sandwiched between them was a Conservative government under Edward Heath. And it was that Conservative government under Edward Heath who took us into Europe. And we didn't enter the European community until 71 or early 72. But basically, we were taken into the EC after a more than decade-long process where the French kept vetoing British membership, largely because de Gaulle was French leader at that time and he just did not like the British. Anyway, by the time we eventually did join the EC, it was on terrible terms, very advantageous terms for Britain. And I think, I don't know this for a fact, but I'm pretty sure that the reason why it happened was because Edward Heath, I mean, this is a fact, was a paedophile. And therefore, ultimately controllable. So, very, very easy to manipulate him into signing a treaty that was so disadvantageous to Britain. And it's really, Brexit is really all about, when you cut through all the rest of it, overturning that very bad move that Heath made back in 72.
Right.
And that's the thing. People's memories are very, very short. And they forget they forget things like this. I mean, I don't think most people probably couldn't even tell you when we joined the EU or why. And then,
and for them to know about the paedophilia angle is even less likely, despite the fact that with Jimmy Savile, this is now a topic that everybody has heard of.
A lot of people know that Ted Heath was a kiddie fiddler. It's become widely known, but they don't mind. I mean, they don't care because Ted Heath's long dead. You know, you can't do any harm now.
Right. It's the same types of people doing the same types of things today that maybe we should be concerned about.
Well, I'm sure that the Liberal and Labour parties aren't completely free of it. But when it comes to the Conservative Party, if you see a senior Tory figure, I'm pretty... I shouldn't really say this, but it's my opinion that most of them are paedophiles, because that's how they get to that level. That I think there is a glass ceiling where, you know, to get past that entails entry into the establishment. And the only people who are allowed into that little club are people that they can control, which means they're either a paedophile or they've got some other deep thing that they can blackmail and control them over.
Well, that's what Gordon Duff says about the Republicans here in the U.S., that says that for all the faults of the Democrats, most of them do their evil deeds with grown women. It seems like there's a parallel there where you know, these so-called conservative parties end up with the most extreme sort of hypocritical criminals representing them.
Well, my opinion is that the right-wing parties, be it the Conservatives in Britain or the Republicans in America, their raison d'etre is to maintain the status quo where we have this small, extremely powerful and mega-rich elite, and then everybody else is just scum that we don't care about.
But the left parties have joined that bandwagon with, you know, the Clintons in the 90s, although they, you know, in some ways they presided over a reasonably good economy overall. That was what set the stage for the destruction of the American working class. And the UK, Tony Blair, is a man of the same kind. And there are rumors about his paedophilia as well.
It surprised me.
Yeah.
There is a claim that in 84 or 85, Tony Blair was in court for, I can't remember the exact legal terms, something like pecuniary sexual services.
Soliciting people in a toilet or something like that.
But he was dressed as a transvestite, apparently, when he was doing so. Well, whether it's true or not, I don't know. Because once he got the power, I'm sure any court records disappeared. But what happened with Tony Blair was that he was selected early on, even before his political career started, as an instrument by which they were going to destroy the Labour Party. Because Tony Blair destroyed the Labour Party and created New Labour, which was just the Conservative Party in red clothes. And there was, so throughout the Blair years, there was no socialist party in Britain, because New Labour certainly wasn't.
And well, this is where Corbyn is so dangerous, because Corbyn is bringing back kind of the real Labour Party, and he's a very, you know, a decent, attractive kind of person to vote for, as opposed to people like Blair.
Yeah, exactly. And he has purged as many of the Blairites out of the party as he can. He's got rid of most of them, but like Putin in Russia, his power isn't endless. So, you know, there are some that he can't just kick to the side. He's got to work and undermine them for a while before he can get rid of them. Which is why there are still some oligarchs left in Russia, because, you know, Putin's had to erode their power while building his own, so he can then deal with them. You know, Corbyn's done as much as he can, but it's not a task that's complete yet. The Labour leader before Tony Blair was a Scottish man called John Smith, and he stuck out like a sore thumb in Westminster politics, because everybody liked him, regardless of political affiliation, because he was a thoroughly decent human being, and he would have been a superb Prime Minister. He would have, you know, he would have transformed Britain, you know, and I'm pretty sure they killed him. Because there was nothing wrong with him, and he was in his 50s. He wasn't the slimmest man you've ever seen, but he wasn't ill in any way, and he dropped dead of a heart attack. Which left the way completely open for Tony Blair to take over the Labour Party. And it wasn't just Tony Blair, it was Peter Mandelson as well. Peter Mandelson is a Jew of the old school of British Jewry that had been part of the British elite for centuries. You know, the same Jews who are the banking families that set up Hong Kong, you know, that fought the Opium Wars. And he's very close friends with the Rothschilds. But Peter Mandelson's just an Israeli agent. And ultimately, that's all Tony Blair was. And the New Labour was nothing more than a front, for an Israeli operation. So under the Blair government, Britain was pretty much a supplicant of Israel. And the same is true ever since, because although Gordon Brown, who replaced Tony Blair as Labour leader, lost to David Cameron, David Cameron all his life has been working for the Zionists. I mean, back in the early 90s, when he was fresh out of university, he was the one who went to South Africa with Dr. David Kelly to supposedly look at the South African nuclear weapons program and oversee its decommissioning and the decommissioning and disposal of the handful of nuclear warheads that they built. Yes, which was a completely... what's the word? Well, it was a farce, because it wasn't. Those nuclear warheads weren't disposed of and destroyed. They were sold on the black market.
Right. Yeah. That there's a whole story about this. Gordon Duff has claimed that basically the Israelis pilfered them, and a couple of them ended up in North Korea, and that the Israelis managed to trick the Americans into thinking that it was possible that the Iraqis under Saddam Hussein had them, and they basically played games with these to leverage their position.
Mm-hmm. I think it's true.
Might even have had something to do with 9/11 and the war in Iraq. That is, there were perceptions of some kind of nuclear crisis before 9/11. This might have been used to sell 9/11 in the U.S. Mm. There's that quote from the FBI informant Randy Glass, who said that he was working in, you know, trying to intercept weapons shipments to terrorists, including nuclear material, and he was working with some dicey Pakistanis who pointed to the Twin Towers in the summer of 2001 and said, "These are coming down." And Randy heard other things like that too, so he got kind of concerned. And he was told by his superiors in the FBI to talk to a high up at Colin Powell's right-hand man at the State Department, a guy named Francis X. Taylor. So Randy Glass calls the private phone number of this Francis X. Taylor, and Taylor answers, and the first thing he says before Randy can even talk is, Randy, we know about the planes that are going to hit the towers. You got to keep your mouth shut. We're tiptoeing through a nuclear minefield now. Don't talk about this ever again with anyone, including your superiors. Mm. So that nuclear minefield comment, plus all the nuclear references, if you may remember in the newspapers, the mainstream papers post 9/11, there was a whole, you know, does Al-Qaeda have nukes thing going with, you know, Russian nukes from, you know, their arsenal that have been traded on the black market and, you know, blah, blah, blah. There was a whole nuclear angle there. And my guess, it's, you know, I don't have hard evidence for this, would be that that plus the, you know, the AQ Khan scandal from Pakistan, where, you know, Pakistan was supposedly shopping nuclear weapons around the world. And then the Israelis talking about, you know, claiming that nukes had been stolen from South Africa. All of this was used to create a kind of a nuclear panic among American decision makers to promote the idea that something really big had to be done. We had to take the gloves off. And so, hence 9/11. You got to go with it, because if we did, that smoking gun could be a mushroom cloud kind of talk. So that's my sense of partly how they sold it.
I think you're on the ball there. And one thing I didn't mention that supports what you just said is that it wasn't really a South African program. It was a joint South African-Israeli program.
Right.
And, you know, the Israelis have to do things out of sight. They're way better than South Africa. To work. And you know, the 1979 nuclear test, that's still denied to this day, but it happened, on, it's an island halfway between the bottom of Africa, Prince Edward Island. They blew it up. They set a nuclear bomb off on it. And it was picked up by one of the American hotel surveillance satellites. The flash of it was. And that was a test carried out by the Israelis and the South Africans together. And, you know, the recipients of the warheads that came out of that program was always intended to be Israel more than South Africa. Because why did the South Africans need nuclear weapons? What are you going to do, nuke the Namibian desert? You know, nuke the highlands of Malawi, where there's nothing but tea plantations and poor people? They don't. The South Africans never needed a nuclear weapon. So I'm pretty sure that most of what was produced out of that nuclear program was always intended to go straight to the, you know, to Israel. And it was probably hedging their bets because they only have, or they only had, the one reactor at Dimona. And we know that, God, from about 84 or 85 onwards, it wasn't working anyway because they broke it through overusing it. Thanks to the whistleblowing of Mordecai Vanunu. Yeah, what people must grasp and what the mainstream media never say is that when they keep banging on about terror states owning nuclear weapons, whether it be Saddam's Iraq or in the current day Iran and North Korea, what they really should say is the real nuclear terror state, the one that's got an undisclosed nuclear arsenal that is a sponsor of terror, that is a threat, is Israel.
Right. And they may even be using mini nukes in terrorist events. There are the Bali bombing is the obvious one. That's been, Joe Viles wrote that great series showing that there's no way that a car bomb, not even a truck bomb, but it was supposedly like a car with explosives in the trunk, created a huge crater. All sorts of evidence that that was some kind of mini nuke. And there seems to be similar evidence in various other cases. Some have argued that 9/11 may have been partially a nuclear event as well.
Well, this is something that I've studied in depth with Jeff Smith, VT's nuclear expert. And we're of the opinion now that the use of small tactical mini nukes has been so widespread, we could even be looking at hundreds of occasions. I mean, just to give you an example, you remember, you will remember the Oklahoma City bombing.
Right.
That was a nuke.
Well, they found unexploded bombs in the building afterwards that were conventional bombs.
Yes. But if you look at the pictures, look at the way that it looks like you took a cookie cutter, a round cookie cutter, and stuck it straight through the building, which is the same damage that you saw on 9/11 and Building 6.
That's right.
The building next to it. That's because a nuclear weapon has gone off and vaporized everything above it. And if you look at the pictures where you can see cars in the parking lot outside, they're toasted in exactly the same way that the cars were toasted on 9/11. Complete with puddles of solidified aluminium under the front, which was formerly the radiator, because all American cars of the last 20, 30 years have had air conditioning. And in an air conditioning system, you have a pressurized steel canister full of Freon. And Freon is 22 or 24% hydrogen. And when you bombard a pressurized metal container that's got hydrogen in it, with hard radiation, such as you get from a nuclear fission event, the hydrogen in that container undergoes what's called the Hall-Round effect. And the hydrogen nuclei start to fuse, and you get a nuclear fusion event, which boosts the size of the bang that you get vastly. It's how you make a hydrogen bomb. All hydrogen bombs are based on what's called the Teller-Ulam two-stage design, where it's simply a normal nuclear weapon that you strap a metal tank of hydrogen to, so that when the nuclear bomb goes off, the hydrogen undergoes fusion and vastly boosts the yield of the explosion. Well, when these small metal cylinders of hydrogen in the car's AC system are bombarded with the hard radiation coming off a nuclear explosion, they also undergo fusion and go bang, but they're only small, so it's just like a hand grenade going off, pretty much. But the heat is enough to toast the car and melt the aluminium radiators, which is why you see these puddles of solidified aluminium under the front of the car.
So the toasted car is cited by Judy Wood, can be explained this way.
Yeah, Judy Wood is a clever disinfo operation, because 95% more of what she says is spot on. She then leads you over a cliff by talking about being directed energy weapons, which is nonsense. In effect, directed energy weapons, to use the most crude definition of that term, did destroy the Twin Towers, but it was nothing to do with whatever Judy Wood talks about, because the towers were a steel tube inside another steel tube. And when they set off the nuclear weapons that were in vans that were parked in specific spots in the underground parking structure, the blast all was directed upwards by this tube within a tube structure. So, in the very crudest sense, it was a directed energy weapon, because all of the energy of the nuclear blast was directed upwards by the waveguide formed by the tube within a tube design of the tower.
Right, and of course, one problem with that explanation in and of itself is that when we actually look at the towers being blown up, that we see them being blown up from the top down, and mm-hmm. it seems you would think that the bomb's radiation or energy would going up this tube structure would kind of hit it from the bottom up, and so what you would see would be basically just a plain old collapse. But we're actually seeing stuff, you know, huge explosions blasting giant 100-ton steel frame members upwards and outwards to impale themselves in neighboring buildings, and it happens from the top down. So how could energy released from the basement or the parking garage cause this effect of boom, 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 right on down from the top, as described by the firefighters?
Because like in Oklahoma City, it wasn't just a nuclear bomb. They had also laced the thing with cutting charges all the way down. And 9/11 loose change, which is a complete piece of disinfo, but if you they actually, quite a bit of it is accurate, when they keep showing you that the puffs coming out as the building's coming down, that are far ahead of the pyroclastic cloud that's the cutting charges going off. So, and also the reason why it's top down is it's like a volcano. All that energy has just rushed straight up the central, this central tube of the tower, and blasted out the top like a volcano. So what, and that cloud was a pyroclastic flow, just like you get from a volcano.
But it didn't continue to go kind of up, you know, through the top of the building or anything like that. What we see is the level where the plane impacted is the place where there's kind of, well, first there's a crimp at the top, kind of the antenna dropped in the North Tower. The antenna drops straight down to show that the core has been somehow removed. Yeah. And then there's this huge explosive event at the level where the plane supposedly hit. And then you see kind of the top of the building. This happened with the South Tower even more obviously after it tilted. The top chunk above the plane strike zone sort of disintegrates, just turns into dust. And then the area below the supposed plane strike zone starts being blown to bits from the top down, boom, 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 right on down at a very high rate, you know, near free fall. So that's what you witness. And what you're describing, it sounds like it could possibly account for this kind of near instant removal of the core columns and the antenna drop and all of that. But some, as you're saying, you would have to have cutter charges or other kinds of explosives, and it looks to me like pretty serious explosives to account for the boom, 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 you know, going from that plane strike zone on down.
I wouldn't be surprised if they had placed one or more small nuclear weapons within the central core, especially in the tower that broke in half. Mm-hmm. And the top fell over.
But the top, it should have fallen over, but the thing was it just turned to dust. So could a nuclear weapon do that?
Yes. The type of weapon they used was specifically designed to destroy large steel structures. The idea was, with they're called the subatomic demolition munition, and the idea was you would take some very brave special forces guys, strap these subatomic demolition munitions to them and kick them out of a plane over Germany to land in front of the Axis of advance of the Red Army in a World War III scenario and blow up all the railway bridges and road bridges, which are nearly all steel structures. And the way that it works is that around your nuclear weapon you place a jacket of iron oxide, and when this iron oxide is turned into plasma by the nuclear explosion, it vaporizes steel. I don't understand the physics beyond that, but it was a specific type of nuclear weapon that had been designed to destroy large steel structures, and the World Trade Center was a large steel structure. And you're familiar with the bit of video footage that people call the spire, that's a large section of steel that's still standing for a few seconds and then just goes poof. That is the evidence of the use of nuclear weapons, because what you're seeing right before your eyes is the vaporization of steel by radiation.
And so at that point, there's still a nuclear weapon going off and vaporizing that?
Well,
because this is after most of the building is down.
You've got a vast flux directly upwards of hard radiation, and that's what took the spire out, that blast of radiation that's going upwards. Because a nuclear detonation isn't like a chemical detonation where, you know, bang and it's gone. It takes a while, because you have got a chain reaction going on. So the length of the output of blast and heat and radiation is determined by how long the chain reaction goes on for. Now, if the chain reaction goes on for, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 seconds, then you are getting a much longer output of blast and heat and radiation. And that's what you're seeing, that In each tower, there was 500,000 tons of concrete and steel, and between 60 and 70% of that was vaporized, is perhaps not the right term, so I'll use dustified. It's probably not scientific. But we're talking about blasting this concrete and steel into a dust cloud formed of particles that are 80 to 110 microns in size, which is the size of a grain of pollen. It's like very fine.
It's comparable to talcum powder.
Exactly. And you know, when Judy Wood says, where did the towers go? They spread out all over Manhattan as a great big cloud of dust. And that's why instead of a 20 to 30 story high pile of rubble that you would have got if it had pancaked, like the official story, you got a, I can't remember how many stories high it was, but it was...
It's just a few, at most. Yeah.
Yeah. That's because 60 to 70% of the material isn't there. It's floating around as dust or covering... you've seen the pictures. The dust cloud covers the whole of Manhattan Island. Yeah, it spits out...
So basically, Judy Wood is right then that this was a demolition modality that did use a form of directed energy that then, quote-unquote, dustified much of the mass. And yeah. Presumably part of the reason for doing this, as Judy says, would be to make sure that the mass slamming down from these towers not only wouldn't be impacting other buildings too much, but would also not destroy the so-called bathtub, which was the system holding the East River out from flooding the entire underground of New York, including the subway and train system, which would have been a mega disaster. So if you want to take down those towers and make sure that you don't destroy that bathtub and flood the whole subway, you would want to be able to remove a lot of the mass of the towers so it wouldn't come crashing to Earth. So that argument of hers, you're saying, is essentially sound.
Yeah. I'm preaching to the converted here, you know this, but the effective disinfo operations are ones that give you 95 or more percent accurate information, and then in order to just steer you off and confuse you.
But the problem, Ian, is that even earnest truth seekers, honest and earnest truth seekers, rarely get above 95% accuracy. So what's the difference between ordinary discourse and disinformation?
Well, not in practical effect, very little. And we are, unfortunately, in the situation where to go that last few percent that fills in the picture, you're really reliant on the disclosure or leaking or whistleblowing of some important information. And that rarely, rarely happens.
And people can fill in the details on this with the nuclear stuff, with the Jeff Smith's nuclear series at Veterans Today, which is a pretty amazing compendium of information. I mean, it's really, it should be published as a book, but it's actually better online because it's all linked and hyperlinked and so on. But yeah, that's great stuff.
There's a lot of classified information in that series.
Right. So just telling you to read this is probably a crime, and it'll get Homeland Security coming to my door. But it's definitely worth looking at.
It will be one day.
Right. So Ian, we only have a minute left. I kind of envy you in having somebody good to vote for, whether or not they're going to stop him with their false flag terror attacks. Jeremy Corbyn seems like a really good guy. I haven't seen anybody that good in a major party who even had any chance at all to win here in the United States for, I don't know, probably not in my lifetime. In fact, I can't think of any American major party candidates in history that I like as much as Jeremy Corbyn. So look on the bright side, at least you have somebody worth voting for.
Yeah. I very much agree with you. And to any English person out there within the sound of my voice, please vote for Jeremy Corbyn. Do the world a favour. And don't vote for yet another puppet of the elite, please.
Well, let's hope that the false flag awareness spreads fast enough to help with this. It did seem that the big Brexit Joe Cox, a possible false flag, you know, blaming the Joe Cox murder on a Brexit supporter, actually backfired. There was a lot of skepticism about that. Maybe the skepticism that you cite will actually help Corbyn. Inshallah.
Inshallah, indeed. Thanks.
Okay, well, thank you, Ian, for staying up so late. It's 3 a.m. where you are. Get some rest. Keep up the great work, and look forward to talking again.
Thank you. Likewise. Good night.
Good night. That's Ian Greenhall of VeteransToday.com. I'm Kevin Barrett, also of VeteransToday.com. The website is TruthJihad.com. Back with another live show next week, same time, same channel, God willing. Anyway, happy Ramadan, blessed Ramadan to everybody, and have a... Thank you.